Okay. One of the things that I constantly talk about is hermeneutics, and I'm sure that some of you are probably like, oh my God, that's another lesson on hermeneutics. You know, how many hermeneutics are we going to come up with before we come to a place where we can resolve these issues? I have, like every Bible teacher, every translator, every scholar, I have my agenda. And if you think that scholars and translators and all these people do not have agenda, guess what? They all do. My agenda is to try to understand things from the first century culture and the way that they were believing that Yeshua was a first century, was in the first century, was an Orthodox Jewish rabbi. That being said, one of the things that we have to do is do hermeneutics. When I sit down to this piece of text, it's not like, you know, waiting for the magic light to turn on and say, oh, I got it now. There's a lot of work involved. There's plenty of reading back and forth in Greek and Hebrew, etc. But now, if you go for a second to page 26, I think. At the top of the page, you'll say, well, we'll read the last sentence from there. It says, which it's, so then my brethren, I'm reading from 25 and we'll go to 26. So then my brothers, you were brought to death, allegorically speaking. However, through faithful obedience to the Masorah and the incorporation into the body of Messiah, you, like the allegorical woman belonging to another, i.e. Messiah, who was raised from the dead in order that we may bear first fruits. Okay. If you take, for example, and now looking on page 28, where that you have, where it says textual analysis, you have a set of words that when you read them from the Nazarene Codicil, you don't come up with a verbal tally to the Torah Seder, which is a tremendous problem, because everything, if the thesis is correct, that everything in the first century was followed the triennial cycle, and that the Nazarene Codicil was in unison and in harmony with the Torah readings of that time, and that the Nazarene Talmudim and the Hakamim knew exactly how to choreograph their writings with the Torah and elucidate the Torah, then you have to be able to make a legitimate connection between the two pieces of material. Okay, so we have to be able to make a connection between the Nazarene Codicil and between the Torah Seder. If you, I don't know what Bible software any of you have, but if you were to, this particular week, if you were to look up, looking back at the text for a second on page 26, you will not find it written out as first fruits in most translations. Most of your translations will come up with the word fruit, okay? But here's the difficulty. When you read fruit, even in English, knowing that the Torah Seder was Bikurim, Yom HaBikurim, you should automatically, a flag should raise in your head saying, hey, look. So then if you went back to the verbal tallies and you tried to look at the verbal tally to see if that word is there, you notice that that word is absent from the verbal tally. Now, I know enough Greek to probably get me in trouble. And to be annoying to a bunch of other people. But, again, not knowing exactly what type of Bible software you have, I use some expensive Bible software, some not so expensive Bible software, and a lot of freeware. Now, a tool that is readily available on the web is eSword. Okay, you can download it and you have different modules, etc. I use eSword, but I use eSword for two basic things. That's primarily what I use it for. Three things. Okay? There is a text called the Apostolic Polyglot Bible, which puts all of the Torah and the Nazarene Codicil in Greek to Strong's numbers. Okay? So if you're understanding what I'm saying, you should know that when you go to study the Torah or you're in the Tanakh, everything's in Hebrew. So you would normally receive Hebrew Strong's numbers, and then you would look at those words in Hebrew. The Apostolic Polyglot Bible, what it does is it looks at the Strong's numbers, the Greek Strong's numbers, and it puts them in there through the entire Bible with the Nazarene Codicil coded to the Greek numbers. Which is important because we understand that the Nazarene Codicil was written in Greek, and also at one point in time there was a Septuagint was in Greek. Okay, it still is in Greek, but there's a difficulty with some of the definitions that come through with the Apostolic Polyglot Bible. And the Apostolic Polyglot Bible, what it does is it gets its definitions from the Septuagint. Okay, now this is a problem. What's the problem?
Because Septuagint has some Hebraisms in it that doesn't fit the Greek language.
Actually, it has a lot of Hebraisms in it. Okay, it's a very Hebraized Greek, if you will. So scholars try to say that it's in classic Greek, and that's nonsense. It's closer to classic Greek than the Nazarene Codicil, but it's not classic Greek, and the reason being it has all the Hebraisms in it. Okay, the problem is that the Septuagint existed nearly 200 years before the time of Messiah, and so the Greek, by the time we reach the Nazarene Codicil, has gone through a tremendous amount of change. You can imagine just in our culture today how much the language has changed, and then apply the same situation. My friend Joseph Good always uses a wonderful analogy. He talks about the movie Back to the Future. And if you remember in the movie, I don't know if you've ever seen it or not, but in the movie the young boy goes through time back to the time that his mother and father were his age, etc. And he goes into a restaurant and he wants to get something to drink, and then he tells the guy, "I want a Pepsi free." And he says, "Listen, buddy, if you need a Pepsi, you're going to pay for it." And then he said, "Okay, then give me a tab." And he said, "You got to order something first." And so he comes to the place, I think, that he wants something caffeine-free, and I think the guy gives him a glass of water or something. But the thing is, just you can even see from in our history, recent history, you know, how these things, you know, to kids today, they won't even know what a tab or a Pepsi-free is. But at that particular time, it is what it was. But you can see how the language has changed, so the same situation applies to the Nazarene Codicil and Septuagint, meaning that the Nazarene Codicil now uses words that are not in the Septuagint. And this can be a difficulty because there are many new words, but that just makes the job a little bit harder. Okay? But there is a plug-in or an add-in or a module, I guess you should say, with the eSword that you can get, I think it's right off of their site. It is a Strong's Plus dictionary, and it's a Strong's Plus dictionary for Hebrew and Greek. So let's say that you click on a particular Greek word in the eSword, and it will come up with the definition to that word. But underneath it in this particular dictionary, it will have all of the possible Hebrew variables that word can be translated into. Are you with me? So in other words, you know, what people would tend to think is that, you know, there's always a one-to-one word translation from Hebrew to Greek. That is not true. Okay? Many words are used in different ways, and then this variable goes back and forth in Greek and in Hebrew. And so this tool becomes a very good tool for trying to figure out how it's connected in the Greek and Hebrew language. Got something too.
I was just going to, edify what you said. Sometimes there's entire paragraphs trying to explain which words are available, and some of them are even exact opposites, which is why what advantage / disadvantage does the Jew have? Absolutely none, and now we're just confused.
Well, His Eminence, I talked about the Jewish thing, and I think we did this in class. The difficulty is that when a Jew, we had a personal conversation, but when a Jew comes to the Torah, the Nazarene Codicil, if he does not do his homework and think like he's supposed to think, he will come to the same exact results that the Christians have. But that's because he's using Christianized means of interpretation, not Jewish or rabbinic hermeneutics. If you apply rabbinic hermeneutics, you will come away with a totally different answer than Christian commentaries have come to this date. Okay, so this particular little module will help you so that if you look at a particular word in Greek, then what you can do is look at those words and see how that word is also used in the Septuagint, and then you can also find the Hebrew parallels, okay? Maybe sometime we'll try to give a class on that or something, because it's a marvelous tool.
Strong's Plus.
Strong's Plus. It's a Strong's Plus, and there'll be a Strong's Plus, and I think it's like for Greek and Hebrew, but if you go through the modules, you'll find the Strong's Plus. Is what you're looking for. Make sure you have the Apostolic Polyglot Bible, and then have it with the numbers turned on so you can read in the numbers in Greek. Okay, so this is what happened this particular week. Looking for the word, you know the word fruit. I know the word for fruit, as you can see on page 28, is carpels. And if you look at carpels, then you know that carpels is the fruit. If you back up and then you look at carpal choreo, you'll look and find that you could almost see the root in the word, but you can see that this is a compound word and it's not back to its root. Now here's the other positive thing about the eSword. eSword will be faithful to always take every word back to, if you search it through its search engines, it'll if you keep following it, this comes from. If you will follow that, you will always go back to its root. Okay? And so this is what we did here. And when we went back to the root carpels, then what we saw in that particular root was the possibilities, the Hebrew possibilities. And it just so happened that the first possibility, the most used in this particular situation, was the word bikurim. Okay?
First fruits.
So that shows us how it should be translated in the Nazarene Codicil, and it makes it connect immediately with the Torah, Torah Seder, because the second word in the Torah Seder is Bikurim, first fruits. Okay? Any questions or comments on that before we move on? That was clear as mud, right? Okay. Now let's look back at page 25 for a second. If you have your English published Bible. And I'm looking at a New King James here. So I want you to just follow along. You can be on page 25 as well. And this is New King James. It said, or do we not know, brethren, for I speak to those who know the law, the Torah. Okay, this is an intimate understanding. The word knowledge is da'at. Da'at always means an intimate awareness of what is being spoken of here. So in this particular case, it's the oral Torah. We'll talk about that more in a minute. He said that the law has dominion over a man as long as he lives. Is that statement correct or incorrect?
Only if you're subject to it. I mean, if you don't make yourself subject to it, the law can still be over you, but if you ignore it...
Okay, but it's still over you, right?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's still over you. Right. You're still under its dominion and authority.
Right, and you're still going to suffer the consequences
right.
of what you do.
Right, okay. So it's not a negative statement to say that a person who is alive is under the authority of the Torah. Okay, we have to be. And that can be a place for further discussion, but let's move on. Now it says, verse 2, it said, for a woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband. Okay? If you are Jewish and you hear those words, there's two or three things that are going to pop into your head immediately. Number one, as we pointed out in the bottom of page 25, in footnote 17, there is a tractate in the Mishnah, in the Oral Torah, called Nashim. Nashim is for women. Okay, so it deals with women's issues, things that are connected to women's issues. Okay, so if we look at the tractates in Nashim, and then we look at this particular passage, we understand that this passage is a general reference to women who are married. Okay? Now, let's see if we can do this. Go to page. Page 7. Okay, first law to remember, there are 7 here, and this is not speaking directly to Remez, but nonetheless, these will be more defined in Remez than they are here. But number 5, definition of a general by a particular and a particular by a general. Okay, we can read it also. Definition of a general, by a specific and a specific by a general. Okay, so one of the things that you have to keep in mind when you're reading the text, is this a specific statement or is it a general statement? And in the present case, it is a general statement about women. He's not being definitive, saying that this woman would violate this law, that law, etc. Therefore, then we have to understand this generality or this general and be specific about the general and interpret the specific. And when we come up with that, we know exactly what he's talking about. He's talking about a contract between a man and a woman. In Hebrew, you call it a ketubah, okay? It's the marital agreement, the marital contract. And that's what's being discussed here. But keeping that in mind, understand that the conversation is in generalities, okay? Everybody with me so far? Questions, comments? Okay, so he's talking about that. Now, stop for a second. He says in the next paragraph, we'll read, he talks about Bikurim, and he's making an association between the first fruits and his commentary. How on earth is talking about a woman's marital contract got anything to do with Yom HaBikurim? Either guy, you know, they got some of that Israeli gold, that Acapulco gold or whatever they used to. You know it's legitimate, right? You didn't know it's legitimate?
No.
Huh?
No.
You didn't? Genesis chapter 1. Then, verse 11. Then God said, let the earth bring forth grass. Right? Just in case you were questioning, it says the herb yielding seed. And then you go on down, and it says in verse 6, or 12, excuse me, after he's considered making the herb with seed, he said, and it was good.
Got it, man.
You better not say that in your class. You probably should just leave that one completely alone in that class. Those they're going to say, you know what he said in class?
You're absolutely right.
Okay. Why would Chacham Sha'ul bring the idea of this woman who could potentially be, he does not make her so, but it could be a adulteress. Why does he bring that into the conversation? If he's talking about Yom HaBikurim. One thing you should know, it's also known as Shavuot. Okay? Now, Shavuot is the feast that is typically called Pentecost, okay, in circles. Pent being 50, associated with the 50th number. And so it deals with that particular thing. Let's go to Shemot, Exodus 19. Starting verse 16, and it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunderings. It was not thunder. In Hebrew, it does not say thunder. Arlene, you got that open to Shemot 19, Exodus 19? In verse 19, on the word where it says thunders, what is that word?
When the sound... when the sound of the horn grew louder and louder...
Now, what's the sound?
Moses was speaking and no, God...
There's a sound there. Verse 19.
Excuse me,
16. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
And it came to pass on the third day in the morning, there were thunderings.
And it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunderings and lightnings. And
what's thunderings? Can you got a definition of thunderings?
No.
Oh, okay. Kolot. Kolot. In Hebrew, kol is a voice. You did not hear one voice. They heard voices. Thunderings is not voice. Sounds is not thunderings. It's voices. They heard these thunderings, and there was a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the shofar was very loud, and all the people in the camp trembled. And Moshe brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood mikat underneath the mountain. So God has the mountain suspended over the heads of the Jewish people. And he says to little Moshe, You going to keep the Torah?
Absolutely.
He's looking around and saying, yeah, I'm going to keep the Torah. Good answer. Right? What would happen if Moshe said, no, I'm not going to keep the Torah? He doesn't have to make a grave, right? This is all done. Okay. Now that's one explanation, but the other explanation is that here the mountain is suspended over the heads of the Jewish people because on that day they were in such unity that they were all spoke with one voice, so to speak. And they're speaking with the voice. They said, we will do and we will hear. Something's wrong with that order. Right?
In this case, it's first we're going to do what you tell us, and then you can tell us why.
Okay? And so the sages say now that the mountain being suspended over their head is not the threat of God that you have to keep these commandments in some coercive measure. What it is that now what he has is a chuppah over the top of the Jewish people, and he takes Israel to be his bride, Kala. Okay? Now, you can now all of a sudden see why Hakam Shaul brings the woman who has the potential for adultery into the conversation, right? Has Israel ever been accused of that? Okay, so you can understand what Hakam Shaul is trying to say. And then, of course, you can see that he goes on to explain and bring and show that that they are not now under, they are not under this particular principle of sin and death, etc. Now I want to move forward just a minute with regards to some of the things that we say about the sounding of this particular shofar, and I want to try to get a couple of things worked out so we can see something new this evening, I hope. In verse 16, so it came to pass on the third day, I'm reading my translation. Now on the third day, when it was in the morning and there was thunder, the voices of the Hakamim and lightning flashes, the flashes of the Hakamim running back and forth to elucidate the Torah. Now one of the things you should keep in mind is that this is the day, according to the sages, according to the rabbis, they say this is the day that the earth stood still. In other words, at the point of standing at the foot of the mountain, they had come to the place of such absolute perfection that in that moment, they entered into a timeless dimension of perfect perfection. And the world stood still. That is because for a brief moment in time, what happens is everything is exactly the way God has it planned, and it's exactly on His schedule, etc. And it is in that moment a perfected world. Now, the way that all the festivals work, and the way that all the gifts of God work, and if you don't learn anything else from anything that I teach, you should learn this. Number one, first always comes the free gift. Everything that God has to give you is absolutely 100% free. And He allows you to taste of that freedom and that goodness, but just as soon as the goodness is tasted, He takes it away. No, He doesn't take it away. He leaves it, but what it is then is a goal to have to work toward. Just the same way, and this is where Rabbi Akiva Tetz shows his particular specialty, and that is that he shows that in relationships, especially between young men and young women, there's a stage of romance, but in the Torah there is no such thing as romance. But there's this seed of euphoria that's placed in there, and then it's not long before all of a sudden, you know, someone says, I think I married the wrong man or the wrong woman, etc. But the idea is that anybody who's been married for more than a couple of days knows that Marriage is actually very much a work. There are times when you have to give and times when your spouse gives. Now, please throw out the idea that it's a 50-50 relationship. If you have that kind of mentality, your marriage will never survive. Right? Because that means that you give your 50, and then if the spouse is not able to give its 50, then something is deficient. The way that it works, biblically speaking, and according to the Jews, is, you know, okay, it's just that that it has to be worked out. And some days you have to put 75 in, and the other person gives 25, and some days it's the other way around. So in Judaism, the idea is, doesn't matter, somebody has to take up the slack somewhere, and it's perfectly normal. It's nothing deficient when, you know, the mother wakes up some morning and she's got a cold or she's not well, and then the husband has to fill in for those duties, okay? So hopefully you can understand the idea. But on that day, you reach absolute perfection. The perfection was there, and then the perfection becomes a goal for Israel, but not just Israel, for us who have joined through the Messiah, to reach the same perfection of the oral Torah of the Torah. Now, I say here, this is based on a Midrash, that the sages are the voices that were heard. Now let's go back to last week's comments on where we talked about Adam HaRishon when he named the animals. Do you remember? So when he names the animals, we said that what he does is inside of the spiritual dimension, he sees the creatures and the words and the letters that are in the realm of the divine. So in other words, if you could look into the spiritual dimension, you could see a thing's essence, but you could also see, you could see the letters of its essence. Have you seen these new things? They're out in a lot of different Bibles and things, you know, where they put all the different words every which way in a like a paragraph or a picture. If you wanted to talk, say, about Yeshua, it'll say Jesus and then Redeemer, and you know, it'll have all these different words that are associated with it. This is very much, it's very much an idea of what it is. If you try to describe who and what Messiah was, you would have words and words and words, right? And it, then if you could look at what that was like in the spiritual dimension, this is why I said four went into the garden and only one comes out unscathed. Okay? But the idea is now for you to be able, if you could look into the dimension of the spiritual, you would look into the dimension of the spiritual and you would see the essence of a thing, but you would also see the thing as the word. Everybody does know that in Hebrew, the word for word is... And what's the word for thing? Same word. So a word is a thing. A thing is a word. So if you can... That's right. You're right. Right on track. If you can imagine the thing, it's a word. And if you get the word, then you have the thing. Okay? So this is why we say and how we understand that God created the world, right? If He did, if He created the world, what He did was call the thing what it was, and it had to be what it was. Are you with me? Anybody defected yet? Can I take a great big risk? Will you let me have a big risk? Write down three words. Chochma, Bina, and Da'at. Chochma, Bina, and Da'at. Somewhere in the margin you can write down Magid. Once before all time there was a lover. Chochma, and beloved Bina, and the magical bed, the At, in which they played out the unity of their love. The joy of the two of them in that bed was complete, and there was nothing besides their love, and there was nothing they needed to make their happiness more perfect. But one endless afternoon, as they had rested in the bed after long love, the lover laid his head next to the beloved's and began to whisper a story in her ear. He told her of strange and wonderful happenings, and he spoke of a day when the nothing besides their love would teem with things. He told her tales of things themselves, of the fiery outburst that would be the beginning of them, and of the blazing dance that would be the continuance of them, and of the gorgeous singularities that would be the flowering of them, and the endless delight that they would experience in the fulfilling of them. And as he spoke in that bed, in the beloved whispered back to him names of each one of the things in his story. Notice that Chochmah speaks to Bina. When Chochmah speaks to Bina of all the potentials, then Bina takes one thing and calls it a name and makes that thing finite rather than infinite. Calling them out of nothing into being by her words. She said stars, and suddenly the bed was full of stars. And she said planets, and the planets whirled around their heads. She said water, and the floods washed over them. And she said wheat, and there was wheat, and there was grapes, and there was Cattepois, and Sauvignon, and Cabernet Sauvignon. She said fish, and birds, and beasts, and she called forth porgies, and sharks, and hummingbirds, and vultures, and mice, and mammoths. And they sported before them in all of their kinds and numbers. Then she said Monique, and Arthur, and Harry, and Martha. And there were children and women and men everywhere dancing their way home to them in the bed. And even though the things she spoke in being danced in their own seasons and to their own measures, even though they themselves seemed to come and to go, and their dancing were continuously held in being by her voice. And she gathered all of them together in a single diamond, no bigger than a peppercorn, and she placed it in her lover's palm to hold forever. And the diamond was beautiful, and the beauty could never be lost. For if any part of it, in any of its seasons or measure, made itself ugly, she immediately spoke its true name and restored it to its beauty. And the lover saw the diamond, and he loved it, and he loved the beloved because of it. And they and the diamond rested in their mutual bed, and they lived happily ever after. Now, I don't know if you saw the spiritual world in this dimension. It's a story to try to show you what it would have been like to see into the divine realm. And what it is like to look into the divine realm. If you look into the divine realm, then you will see something very interesting. And what you should see is the cosmos, how the cosmos was created. Now, I've said for some time now that the cosmos was created by the oral Torah of God. In other words, God said, let there be, and there was. Therefore, you should be able to peer into the spiritual world, but the way that you appear into the spiritual world is complex, because you will look at words, but when you look at words, you also look at things. And whenever you see a thing, you see its word, etc. They're back and forth. Let's go to the book of Revelation. Thank you.
take up a little corner right here and we'll leave the rest of this on this board.
My guide. My guide. Question. Chapter 1, verse 1. The revelation that God gave to Yeshua HaMashiach, which God gave to him to show to his servants, his courtiers, those things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and put them all in symbols by his angel to his servant John. Now, understanding what we've said many times, that the revelation is a revelation of Yeshua, the revelation is a revelation that God gave to Yeshua, and the Yeshua is going to give this to his servants. Now, here's a problem in the latter part of this verse. And he sent, and he signified it. And I didn't understand how to read that word. And I read it this way intentionally. He put it in signs and symbols by his put in messenger. Angel meaning messenger to his servant John. Now question is, who is the messenger? Or whose messenger is this? Do you understand my question? My question is it John's messenger or is it Yeshua's messenger?
Depends on how you put the Greek together.
So now you guys are starting to get an idea for how you can see things can be said differently in Greek than from the way that they're read in English. Of course, in this particular piece of text, in most Bibles, they will have his capitalized, right? Mm-hmm. And you all are very familiar by now of looking at Greek and knowing that, you know, when there is a capitalized word and et cetera, proper pronoun, et cetera, right? Now, my question in relation to this servant is whose servant is it? Is it John's servant or is it Yeshua's servant? Or, for that matter, it is God. Can it be God's servant? And then we can take in, you know how they do the lottery, right? Got all those little balls in there, and they turn that thing around and around. You reach in and you pull one out. Right? So this is what we got, all the Greek words. We just spin that thing around and around, pull one out, and then we'll have our answer, right? Go to chapter 19. Okay, after a considerable amount of discussion and happenings in the book of the Revealing, there's a particular messenger who's been speaking to Yochanan all along. And in verse 10, he said, "And I fell at his feet to worship him. And he said to me, 'See that you do not do that. I am your fellow servant and of your brethren who have the testimony of Yeshua HaMashiach, who worship, that you are to worship God.' He said, 'For the testimony of Yeshua is a spirit of prophecy.'" Notice here that the word Magid is, I use the word Magid, and the word Magid is associated with a prophet. Okay? In the congregation there is a man called a Magid, and he's a prophet and a Darshan. This is a guy who is the orator of the Esnoga. He gives a lecture, etc., etc. Okay? So, there, the Magid here has also skills, some semi-prophetic skills, partially because he's speaking the Torah, and he's also a Darshan or a preacher. Okay? Fitting into the category of the five-fold ministry, as it were, with seven particular individuals. Okay? 7 different individuals to fill that office. Now, let's pick this apart for a second, and then we'll jump to Ephesians. It said, I fell at his feet to worship him, but he said, do not do that. He said, I am your fellow servant. So in other words, this is breaking down the idea of him being an angel. He's not an angel. Okay, so the person giving the revelation to John is not an angel. He is a messenger. He is a magid. And he says, oh yeah, by the way, he said, I am of your brethren. So obviously you understand that he's Jewish. Right? And so he's giving you here the Magid, and he's saying that this Magid is the one who is giving this to John, and he doesn't want him to worship him because he is in fact... Let's go to the book of Ephesians for a second. Begin to wrap this up. Everybody... thoroughly lost at this point.
Mm-hmm. We're coming around the mountain. We'll get back to it.
Yeah. You can read in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 3. I'll read my translation. It said, let the God and Father, our Master, Yeshua HaMashiach, be blessed, having blessed us in Messiah with every spiritual blessing in the heavens. Okay, notice here the location. Location is in the heavens. Okay, everybody can now begin to see the scenery. Okay, your scenery is in the heavens, even as He, God, has elected, separated us, the Jewish people, to be in union with Him, Messiah, before the foundation of the world, to be Tzadik King. Okay, now, it's interesting here because, number one, they turned out to be the elect. And there's a problem with understanding the word elect. And what you should do is take that e-sword, look at elect, and dissect it. Because what you're going to go to and what you're going to find is that out, E-K, out of something, something was said. And here context is said out of or a place when or before the foundation of the world something was said. So now you can begin to see again the spiritual dimension and understand that the spiritual dimension is nothing but words. But all the words are not just words, the words are symbols. So that when you look at the symbols, or the words, you see the thing. But the reason you see the thing is because it's in words. Am I confusing you again? And you say that this sounds idiotic. You know why it sounds idiotic? Because what we're trying to do is bring out of a spiritual dimension into a natural dimension and have an awareness of what we're talking about. It can't be done. If you see it, nobody, you don't have to have somebody say, did you see it? You see it. You know it. And if somebody said, no, you just have bad pizza. Well, you know you didn't have bad pizza. You know what it is because you've seen it. Okay? So, in this dimension, something takes place, a Torah, a world takes place before time. Words take place before time. Because there's a speaking. The words that God spoke before the foundation of the world were words of creation that caused the whole cosmos to be created. But not only that, just as the story said, he said Arthur, he said Monique, he said whatever, right? The interesting thing about it is when he says Adon Yoel, it can only be an Adon Yoel. It can't be anything else. And he's left his mark on the town, right? But if it gets blemished, what does he have to do? Because it's Hebraic and we understand the power of it, all that means is that he has to call it by its name. Call it what it is. And if he calls it by what it is, then it will be what it is. Okay? Now, you will see also in the Corinthian Ephesians the word holy. The word holy in Greek is agios. And that is, you can be played in a couple of different ways. It's hard to hunt down the root for this particular word, but I play a word game with it, and I say that it is a, which, you know, if you have an atheist, you have somebody that does not believe in God or is opposed to God, right? Okay, so if you have an agios, then you say what? Ge in Hebrew, or excuse me, in Greek, is the world. And then you would have agios is somebody not from the world. To be a holy one is someone not from this world, but from another dimension in time, placed in this particular dimension. Are you with me so far? I knew you weren't from around here. Okay? Now, why do I talk about all of the words and all of these things and then bring us to this word Magid? Back to Revelation 1. And I'll pick up my question and try to summarize.
In a minute, this is a little silly, but I just wanted to point out from studying the alphabet of the Greek, I am Alpha and Omega. He's the beginning and the end. I get that now.
Very good. So then all we have to do is just translate it into Hebrew. It's Aleph and the Tav, and we understand many, many things. My question in relation here again to the fact that on that day, Shavuot, God spoke, it reached the pinnacle of perfection, is, number one, how can that possibly relate to this revelation? But number two, who is this Malach, this angel, this Magid? Who is it? Now, before I come to the place that I end this discussion and conclude this discussion, I will have you know that in the case of some of the spiritual giants over the generations, they were said to have, some of them were said to have a Magid. And this Magid was one who helped them understand their Torah, become aware of, say, prophetic things, etc. And in some cases, when people revealed that they had a Magid that was telling them some things, then people begin to get very nervous, worried about the fact that, here we go, we've got some weirdo out here because he's got somebody speaking to him and he's giving him all these secrets, etc. But you can clearly see that there's a Magid, there's somebody in the book of Revelation that's saying some things that are pretty profound. And this also fits with the idea of what I'm saying with regards to having your head in the heavens and being able to see what it looked like. You read the book of Revelation and you read a few chapters and all of a sudden you're saying, there's more stuff going on here and there's more things going every which way than, you got to discern this from that. But just stop and think about it for a minute if you realize that every last word is a symbol. So how fast could you study the book of Revelation? If every word is a symbol, and you have to understand the symbols. And the books to understand the symbols, they're cheap. You can buy them at the dollar store. I think in some cases it's probably easier to stick your head in heaven, wouldn't it? Okay. Is there my question clear, or have I?
Who is this Magid?
Only the shadow knows. Okay, so now let's try to sum up a little bit. We see here, and go back to 19. We see here that he says he's a fellow servant, and that he has the testimony of Yeshua. Worship God. The testimony of Yeshua, by the way, is to... Say it right there, worship God. Not hard, is it? Now let's go back to 1 again. Taking up the question and saying, whose messenger is it? Is it John's messenger or Yeshua's messenger?
Yeshua's messenger to John.
That's your story and you're going to stick to it?
For now.
John's monkey.
Should you correct
this? Well, it does say the revelation of Jesus Christ.
Uh-huh.
God gave it to him.
God gave to who? To Yeshua. Okay? So the revelation comes to Yeshua, but Yeshua wants to transmit the message, and he transmits the message. Wait. Doesn't say it like that. It says to his servants.
That could mean everybody.
Yeah, it should mean everybody. Everyone that's a servant to Yeshua, right? So in other words, he is going to communicate it to his servants, but...
I don't really know exactly where you're headed, Jeremy. I guess I'm probably heading the exact opposite direction. But
you see my face and my back.
A prophecy was given to everybody, but it was one person's. If I remember correctly, it was all prophets would get the prophecy, but it was also kind of transmitted who the prophecy was intended for.
Right.
And he was the one with the understanding of it.
Who was he?
He who was.
He is who.
He is who, and who is he, and he is she, and dog is fish.
And Debar is Debar.
Not the loaf bar.
So is it possible that when he transmitted it, he transmitted it in the form of prophecy, and everybody, they all had the prophecy, but he's the one that gave them the key.
So my question again is, who is he? Who are you talking about?
Yeshua.
Who is the giver and who is the recipient?
Yeshua gave at least one of his Talmudim the key to understanding this prophecy.
Okay, so...
And that is the one who would have...
Does our text put the servants who are the recipients of the revelation in the singular or the plural?
Let me say it. I'm getting there. I'm in the wrong book. Yeah. Why was it? To show to the slaves of him or the servants of him, and that would be plural.
Okay, so it's in the plural. So let's read it again. The revelation that God gave to Yeshua, which he would show or give or reveal to his servants, those things that have to come about shortly, it says. And then he sent. Who sent? Now your Bible, probably like mine, has it in the capitalized, so you would think, well, this is either Yeshua sending or God sending.
This is actually, in my Bible, is not capitalized.
That's exactly the point. In the Greek, it's not capitalized, and therefore we don't have an emphasis on whether it is God or whether it's Yeshua or anyone else.
It's just somebody.
It is somebody who puts it now in symbols, and he gives it or he signified it by or through, the same word in Greek, his malach or messenger to his servant John.
Yeah, that's the one who's so very spiritual.
Absolutely. Here is my contention. Here is my thesis. Number one, I say, this was Yochanan's Magid. Now I sound like I'm way out on a limb and I got somebody's got the chainsaw wound up and ready to cut me off, right? Keeping in mind how spiritual it really is. Now, how can I possibly make this statement and say this is in fact the Magid that helps John understand this entire thing, other than the fact that we discovered in the 19th chapter that when you're talking about this, it says, he tells him, he said, I'm not God, I'm not somebody to be venerated, I'm one of you. But in this particular case, he's the guy that's giving him the revelation. Okay, everybody knows who the angel of 19 is, right? You want to study, anybody want to study the book of Revelation with us? And I fell down at his feet to worship him, but he said to me, see that you do not do it, because I am a fellow servant and of your brethren who have the testimony of Yeshua. Worship Hashem, and the testimony of Yeshua is the spirit of prophecy. So he has to be a prophet, right? Or associated with a Magid being a prophet and having the capacity of prophecy. So then you would have the opportunity to pick from all the possible prophets that you know, and you would pick. Which prophet of the Torah, the Tanakh, comes the closest to matching the revelation?
I know the answer, but I'm out of time.
Isaiah?
The most mystical of all the prophets, the one who wrote his book, and when he wrote his book, everybody studies it to this day to try to understand on how to ride a chariot. Not Elijah. Not Elisha.
Enoch.
Huh?
Enoch.
Not Enoch.
Ezekiel?
Ezekiel, thank you, sir. Yeah.
That was my next guess.
Ezekiel. That's easy to say now, right?
I was about to start spitting out names that weren't even in the Bible. I mean,
Ezekiel is the most mystical of all the prophets. He sees how they... It's interesting because he sees the fire unfolding and he sees this thing enveloping itself, etc. He sees Har Sinai. He sees what it was like to look at the mountain of Sinai when God was giving the Torah. And then he reveals this as a chariot so that you can visit the spiritual world. But if it's a chariot to visit the spiritual world, one thing you're going to have to do is learn how to see words. Because it said the Jewish people saw the words. It did not say they heard the words, it said they saw the words. Go back to Exodus 19. I think this version, which is chapter 20, excuse me. Now God begins to unfold the revelation at Har Sinai, and as he does, he said, he's Anochi Adonai, he is God, I am God. It's a revelation of God. So the entire Torah is a revelation of God. And it says, now in verse 18, I don't know how your versions read. Somebody have a version, Scott, what does your version say?
Verse 18?
Yes, 20 and 18.
It says, so the people remained at a distance when Moses approached the thick cloud where God was.
18?
20 and
18?
Mm-hmm. 19 and 18.
No, 2018.
All the people were seeing the thunderings and lightnings.
Very good. All the people were seeing the thunderings and lightnings. In other words, they saw the words. They didn't hear the words, they saw the words.
It says after that, it says, and heard the sound of the horn.
Right. So there was a difference between seeing the words and hearing the horn.
Interesting. I have the Jewish publication version, and it says the people witnessed instead of the people.
Yeah, so it's New King James says the same thing. Oh, so if you don't know what you're looking for, and you got witnessed, it throws you completely off track.
Yeah, I can witness something by hearing it.
Don't you think that's why they put lightnings in there, because you can see lightning?
Yeah.
You hear thunder, but you see lightning. So where they took the but hole, the voices.
The voices were what?
But colloqued.
Now.
But.
Who are the voices?
It's not one of the same.
Yeah. There's your problem.
It was.
What's that?
He's talking about a numerical problem with the order between the differences between the Jewish published Bible and the English.
Oh, yeah. Mine's verse 15 for yeah. that.
Right. So. Who are the voices? We said earlier that the voices were the Hakamim. And they're running back and forth is the lightning.
Right.
But you could also say that it's the Magidim. Now, can you answer my question and tell me who... is he? Who is the he of Revelation, and who is the
Magid? Ezekiel.
Huh?
He said
okay.
Ezekiel was the Magid.
Okay, if it's Ezekiel, and he's the most mystical of the prophets, then there one question remains. Don't you love why Jewish people do this? They never end a subject without having a question.
One question remains. You want to get that answer? One question yet remains.
We have this notion, even in Christianity, everybody has a guardian angel. And what this guy does is he runs around making sure that you don't stub your toe and you don't get in car accidents and on and on and on. But wait a minute. People do get in car accidents. Mm-hmm. And people do stub their toe. And what's this guy doing? Is he falling down in his job or what?
He's keeping a record.
He's taking a record, keeping a record? Boy, that doesn't sound good.
Well, that would
make
depend on
make
the list
check.
Find out who's not in nice. It's seasonal, right? Okay, so my question is, could this Magid possibly have been Yochanan's guardian angel? Because the guard, the word guard in Hebrew does not mean some girl running around protecting you. Shomer, it's the guard. In other words, the angel that you have doesn't have the job of running around all day making sure you don't stub your toe and get in car wrecks. As a matter of fact, he did you a great measure of chesed in the very beginning of your existence, and he, for 9 months, read the Torah to you while you were in your mother's belly. And then you come out, and as the story goes, shh. We've all understood that this means that he drives it deep inside. But now, Adon Yehoshua said this guy goes around keeping record. What would he keep a record of?
Sure all the things you did with the Torah that he taught you.
How did
or
you
didn't do
you?
With the Torah that he taught you.
I'm looking at it in a positive light.
So... here we have an angel who taught us the Torah. Interestingly, when we bring him into judgment, he'll say, by the way, he didn't do what I told him to do. As I told him to, and he didn't do this. But let's take this for a moment, just a little bit beyond the idea here. and I will conclude very shortly, I promise. You never trust a preacher when he says
that. You got to tie this back into Romans.
It's a good point.
Yeah, we still don't know how the marriage contract and the Kareem fit first fruit.
I already told you that. I told you, I said that it was under the canopy.
Oh, yeah. It just didn't connect.
Matthew chapter 4. Now, we can understand a couple of things about the temptation of the master to be a struggle with his own personal yetzer hara, which is absolutely the case, but also we can understand that this is something in his case that supersedes what we could possibly imagine or understand. And if you will notice at verse 8, it said, "And the adversary took him up on an exceedingly high mountain, and he showed him all the kingdoms of the world in their glory." What can a McGee do? That's the negative. And we should be able to derive a positive. Right? So if he showed him all the kingdoms of the world and all their glory, then what can the McGee on the positive side, what can he do? Would he think be able to produce a revelation?
You can plug a CD into your head and play it.
Now I'll conclude here. Here's my thesis that the McGee is Ezekiel, but Ezekiel is the guardian angel for Yochanan.
Are you...
No, I didn't smoke any of that stuff first. I talked about it, but I didn't...
Are you putting forth the theory that Ezekiel, like Enoch, achieved a newer or a higher level?
No. Not necessarily. Not specifically.
Or that a shomer doesn't necessarily have to be an angel.
A messenger is a messenger. A malach or an angel in Greek is not an angel with wings. It's a messenger.
So
his shomer, his guardian angel, is not an angel. He's a guardian messenger or a guardian who speaks the Torah to him and reveals the Torah to him so that he has a deeper awareness of the Torah. In his case, Yochanan merited to have the prophet Ezekiel as his Magid.
So it doesn't actually specifically mention an angel as literally an angel, a power of God in the New Testament whatsoever. It's always meaning messenger.
Usually when you see even in Hakam Shul's writings, he talks principalities, powers, demons, etc. Mm-hmm. He's talking about powers. And the idea of a malach in Hebrew is some sort of a power or energy associated with some sort of work that's produced.
Okay,
so it has the ability to produce an end result, but as far as a winged creature, yeah, we have winged creatures in Isaiah, right, who are reciting the Kodesh, but still, those are powers that are invested with an energy, and they have to serve a purpose. In Jewish thought, a malach, an angel, if you will, a messenger, is only alive for the duration of the mission. And as soon as the mission is done, he ceases to exist.
So, how do we rectify that? Well, I guess Enoch's job...
Enoch merited transition because he became that power. He became the Torah.
Well, what I was saying here a minute is that Enoch's position... Well, it's never over, so that's how he...
Exactly.
That's how he gets exactly. his
Well, there are certain angels that they sit and stay holy all day long. Their mission is not
was never really done.
Right. There's a guardian for the people of Israel. His mission is not done, etc. You see what I'm saying? So that does not mean that, you know, just here's one that is done and then it's said and done with. Although, you know, it can be for a specific message. That's it. It's the only purpose he's there for. Something new to contemplate. As a result of that possible thesis, I say...
Each one of us has a Magid.
Each one of you have a Magid. To be able to tap into the spiritual dimension and stick your head in the clouds or spiritual dimension and see things on a level that are far beyond what we've experienced to this point.
So when he wants to give us another paraclete.
Exactly. He said, I'll send another who's the paraclete, but
deserves much thought.
What is the other paraclete? Because the first of all, you understand the Magid in and of itself is the Torah. The Magid is also, here's some things you might want to jot down. Number one, he is, the Magid is the Torah. Number two, the Magid is your Torah teacher. Number three, it's one of the Hakamim. It is the substantial Torah or the Torah personified. So we understand John 1 speaks of the Torah personified, which is Yeshua, right? Okay, so he's a great Magid. Magidim that had existed in history would have been two that stand out. Metatron, Enoch, and Eliyahu. But you are your own Magid in me.